Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I am dog sitting the neighbor's two dogs, so if you hear any high soprano yapping, that one of them would be either Gizmo or Lily or both. Two of my friends with whom I shared a small part of the Vietnam War 50 years ago in 1966 are having birthdays today and tomorrow, April 7th and 8th, John Michael Sweeney and Julius Maxwell Belcher. Sweeney has been both a journalist and a union organizer since repatriation stateside from Vietnam, and Max has become a photographer, particularly noted for his photographic comparisons of his youthful home, Liberia, and the Black American South. They are celebrating their birthdays together, joined by a few other elderly jungle rats of our acquaintance. My friend Rick Vranya, poet and cartographer, died the day before Easter. His fellow poet, Jim Dott, told me of his death this past week. Jim said that Rick was a wonderful poet. He leaves a large hole behind. He was a great voice for the spoken word, and especially poetry. And to my friend and KMUN radio colleague, Ann Goldeen, who died in January, this program is dedicated for her articulate and abiding love for Gaia's garden. A portion of today's program is my annually perennial springtime rant, so I suppose I should offer a disclaimer that among all the flora and fauna in the multiple universes, this is not by any means my opinion only, which will be affirmed by the appeals for fairness and justice following my fustian ruffle. What I wrote, I call Sprays of Spring. And start with a quote by Rachel Carson. The chemical war is never won. All life is caught in its crossfire. Sweet spring, buds, blooms, and blossoms. Sounds of birds and crop dusters. Skies shot with billowy clouds and mists of pesticides. The eternal war against insects and weeds is renewed. We are dusted, misted, sprayed, hosed and powdered with some of the deadliest chemicals ever conceived to kill pickle worms, aphids, leafhoppers, spider mites, cabbage worms, spittle bugs, potato beetles, carpenter ants, Japanese beetles, corn earworms, grasshoppers, codling moths, blister beetles, as well as unwanted plants and weeds. We are exposed to insecticides, miticides, acaricides, nematicides, fungicides, bactericides, avicides, herbicides, rodenticides, piscicides, molluscicides, and treaticides, plus desiccants and defoliants. These pesticides kill by simply touching insects. They kill when swallowed or by being taken into the blood of animals or the sap of plants. They kill through inhalation or by being otherwise absorbed. Selective pesticides are designed to kill only certain kinds of plants, insects, or animals. Non-selective pesticides kill most plants, insects, and animals. These chemicals are sprayed by aircraft, from tanks on trucks, from knapsack containers, hoses, and handheld sprayers. They are dusted, misted, or sprayed over farms, forests, and gardens, and are also used on school playgrounds, golf courses, the lawns and shrubbery of public buildings, and along roadsides. These poisons drift in forms of dust and mist, or move with soil particles by erosion. They leach through the soil into lakes, rivers, and streams, and are carried as residues on crops and livestock, or evaporate and move with air currents. Of course, we are not only assaulted by pesticides from air, land, and water through inhalation or permeation. We drink and eat them also in fruits, vegetables, meats, and milk. 1 billion pounds of these poisons are applied annually within the United States, and it is virtually impossible to live anywhere in the country without being exposed. In many areas, saturated. Wildlife is contaminated. Food chains are affected. Habitat is destroyed, and human life is endangered. Pesticides are linked to cancer, nervous system damage, degenerative changes in liver and kidneys, fetal injury, miscarriages, birth defects, genetic mutations, and other serious diseases. Pesticides occur in mother's milk and in the tissues of unborn children. Exposure to these chemicals cause irreversible changes that alter genetic materials in cells permanently. Pesticide residues and their breakdown products are routinely found in blood and urine samples from both urban and rural residents nationwide. Pesticide residues capable of causing cancer and mutations show up in human sperm samples. A study by the National Academy of Sciences concluded that 28 pesticides known to cause cancer and found in foods might cause more than 1 million cancers over the next 70 years, and the Natural Resource Defense Council, a private environmental group, reports that children's exposure to pesticides and potential harm from these chemicals in food is 6 to 12 times greater than that of adults. Rachel Carson, who sounded the alarm about the dangers of pesticides in her renowned 1962 book, Silent Spring, called these poisons biocides. There are two kinds of biocides, botanical or organic, and synthetic or man-made. Although the first are dangerous enough, powdered arsenic has been used for centuries and has a significant death toll, the synthetic chemicals are unsurpassed in their toxicity. Initial development of these chemicals was during World War II, following the discovery of DDT. Ironically, the growth of the synthetic pesticide industry started in the war years by testing these chemicals on insects as possible agents to kill human enemies. The governmental regulatory process is a failure as much in pesticide abuse as with Pentagon contracts. The political and commercial copulative relationship between agencies and industry rules out any effectively honest regulation of pesticide use and abuse. In fact, government agencies rely on manufacturers' data about pesticide safety with the ingenuous claim the process saves taxpayers' money. Other information about toxicity levels or research is either suppressed or often falsified. The standard used by both government and industry is a so-called safe level of toxicity, though it has been determined there is no safe level of exposure to anything that causes cancer or mutations, which is used short of outright banning of a substance and is generally assumed to not cause immediate harm. As these chemicals are new when first labeled, there is no other method of determining long-range or cumulative effects than wait and see. Even when a chemical is harmful to test animals, industry and government officials say they cannot be sure they are harmful to humans. Labeling information is itself suspect, particularly claims that a pesticide is safe or that its ingredients are non-poisonous. Whenever a substance is banned or restricted, which is seldom, unrestricted use of stocks on hand are usually allowed to be sold and use, while a number of equally toxic chemicals that are in the wait-and-see stage are put into use as replacements. Chemicals that are singled out as a result of harmful effects are rarely equated with the multiple effects of cumulative exposure to dozens of pesticides, often simultaneously. Not only has the ingenuous development of synthetic pesticides outrun the knowledge of their disastrous effects on living organisms, but residues from their manufacture accumulate in largely unregulated dumps where some break down into even deadlier compounds that seep into land, water, and air. Carol Van Strum of Five Forks, Oregon, in her 1983 book, A Bitter Fog, Herbicides and Human Rights, echoed a call by Rachel Carson for a constitutional amendment to protect citizens from environmental poison. To those who bear the risk, she wrote, exposure to poisons is a matter of life and death. decisions about poisons that disrupt the basic mechanisms of life and the biological integrity of future generations raise profound moral questions. Society cannot afford to entrust such decisions to corporate or political entities that exempt themselves from the restraints of morality and ethics. Current law requires a person threatened with exposure to a toxic chemical to prove that irreparable harm will result while the information for such proof is kept secret or not available because not enough research has been done. Not to mention revisions of studies are watered down to support the toxic chemical industry. Van Strum believes, quote, that a society insisting on its right of informed consent would quickly redirect pest control toward non-poisonous methods of integrated pest management. Pest control, she writes, would adopt nature's system of checks and balances essential to a true democracy. Rachel Carson said that the only reason the Bill of Rights contains no guarantees that a citizen shall be secure against lethal poisons distributed whether by private individuals or government officials is because our forefathers, despite their considerable wisdom and foresight, could conceive of no such problem. And that was Rachel Carson. An informed consent amendment is already provided a constitutional basis by the Ninth Amendment, which states that in addition to the specific rights enumerated in the Constitution, there are others retained by the people, quote unquote. History, however, has shown that specific rights must necessarily be specified if they are to be upheld. Nothing could be more specific than two questions posed by Carol Van Strum. Do I or do I not have the right to know the effects of the stuff you intend to expose me to? Do you or do you not have to get my permission before exposing me to it? A constitutional amendment would not be an instant or complete solution to the problems of pesticides, and government and industry will spend millions of dollars fighting it. But as Van Strum says, in opposing informed consent, government and industry would have to admit that toxic exposure does occur and that people have no right either to know about it or stop it. They would have to convince the public that ignorance and helplessness are preferable to knowledge and control. In the meantime, the insects we attempt to eradicate continue to build resistance to pesticides, which provokes development of ever more toxic chemicals. For humans to build resistance will take hundreds of generations, at roughly three generations a century. New insect generations occur in a matter of days or weeks. The chemical control of plants and insects turns out to be a greater menace to ourselves than to its targets. Future historians may well be amazed by our own distorted sense of proportion, Rachel Carson wrote in Silent Spring. How could intelligent beings seek to control an unwanted species by a method that contaminated the entire environment and brought the threat of disease and death even to their own kind? And that was an article I wrote, The Sprays of Spring, with gratitude to Rachel Carson and Carol Van Strum, to Mary Sellen and Dee Myatel of Ocean, and to Helen Patty Hill, whose articles on pesticides in issues of the North Coast Times Eagle provided the essential research for this commentary. I would like to follow up now with an article by Nell Ward of Newport. The people of Oregon deserve better. Lead pipes in Flint, Michigan have brought the dangers of poisoned water into the mass media, but Oregon communities, including those of Lincoln County, have a serious water problem that's not publicized. Every year, helicopters spray pesticides on more than 165 square miles of the state's timberland under the West Coast's weakest regulations without protecting people from the toxic chemicals invading air, water, and soil. Because of their carcinogenic properties, pesticides are banned in many countries. Exposure results in rashes, nausea, headaches, seizures and convulsions, and even death. Some cause nervous system disorders, such as peripheral neuropathy, which begins with numbness and tingling in toes and fingers that spreads to hands and feet, as well as pain, muscle weakness, and sensitivity to touch. Long-term exposure to chemicals used in aerial spraying can injure the liver and kidneys. Velosa can cause irreversible eye damage. Another 2,4-D, key ingredient of Agent Orange, causes skin irritation. Just breathing vapors can cause dizziness. These chemicals were banned on federal land in the 1980s, but Oregon still allows pesticide spraying on private land after logging to allow only the newly planted Douglas firs to survive. Up to 40% of pesticide sprayed from the air drifts away from the targets for 4 or more miles, and Oregon law does not prevent pilots from spraying in windy and rainy conditions. Logging companies spray people, homes, schools, etc., with almost no punishment. More than 200 videos from one company alone show spraying on workers, leaky trucks, and stream pollution. Oregon law allows direct spraying onto small streams that feed into larger ones. Oregon is the first state to have its regulatory program disapproved by the Federal Environmental Protective Agency, and NOAA Fisheries, partially because it did not control the aerial application pesticides. Big corporations taking over logging in Oregon ignore any alternatives to spraying clear cuts because they want only short-term gains by plundering its resources. Small communities like Rockaway Beach must bear the cost of poisoned water, and individuals have serious health issues that take away from worker productivity and cost to taxpayers. Aerial spraying abuse in the state goes back decades. One victim, Melise Connolly, learned that her water had dioxin that killed chicks and ducklings on her farm and made her son sick. Her neighbors had 2 miscarriages and 1 child with multiple birth defects, and every neighboring pregnant woman in her first trimester miscarried. Several children were hospitalized with near-fatal cases of spinal meningitis. Researchers lost the proof of evidence from her farm, and dioxin levels increased 4 times in sediments upstream from Melise's home. 10 years after her water was sprayed with pesticides, Melise died of brain, lung, and breast cancer at 32 years of age. The EPA admitted that the spray was toxic, but its use continues to this day. Last year, aerial spraying over Catherine Rickard's neighborhood in Curry County left her dog dead and herself with 2 surgeries for a sinus infection. Neighbors suffered from severe sinus problems, dizziness, and fatigue. She learned that the timber industry donated almost $600,000 to state legislators in 2014 and told lawmakers that their practices were safe. Senate Bill 613, designed to protect Oregonians against pesticide exposure, failed, not even getting a vote. Its provisions include protective no-spray buffers around homes and schools. None exist today. Notification before spraying without charge. Disclosure of contents and areas of spraying. Currently, companies turn these records over to the state only on request. Opponents of SB 613 claim that existing laws are adequate. Closed-door committee meetings didn't allow anecdotes and news stories about people who have been sprayed. One legislator said he couldn't decide between the safety of pilots facing eco-terrorist attacks from announced plans and people who want to shut their windows and bring in their animals before poisonous spraying. Meanwhile, Oregonians must each pay $25 for advance notification. Information about the contents of aerial spraying is impossible to get, and buffer zones are just a few feet despite knowledge of toxic drift. And people in Oregon, including those of us in Lincoln County, continue to be poisoned by big timber corporations and their donations to legislators. The people of Oregon deserve better from their lawmakers. And that was by Nell Ward of Newport. And she wrote this article for the Newport News Times. And another article from the Newport News Times, Let the People Decide, by Maria Sauce. Right now, the people The right of the people of Lincoln County to decide is under attack. A judge of the Lincoln County Circuit Court will soon determine whether or not to allow gathering signatures for an initiative petition based on arguments heard in court representing the profit-driven interests of industry invested in aerial spraying of pesticides in our county, on the one hand, versus the right of the people to use the initiative petition process to propose new law to protect their safety and that of the environment on the other. The answer should be clear. Let the people decide. The initiative petition in question is titled Freedom from Aerially Sprayed Pesticides of Lincoln County, and it has been put forward by Citizens for a Healthy County. It asks the people of Lincoln County if they want to ban the practice of aerial spraying of pesticides, a practice that has already been banned in federal forests for 30 years, in order to protect our right to clean air, water, and soil, and to stop our continued exposure to toxic chemicals. The judge is not considering whether aerial spraying of pesticides should or should not be banned, but whether the people of Lincoln County can be asked that question through circulation of a petition, which could only become a ballot measure if it receives the required number of signatures. The government of Lincoln County already decided that asking the question is reasonable and should happen. However, on February 29th, the attorney for the party opposing circulation of the petition argued in court that wanting clean air, water, and soil somehow entails a hidden threat to voters, that questioning the authority of industry profiting from aerial spraying of pesticides and the state to force toxic chemicals on our forests, watersheds, and people also entails that threat. Perhaps worst of all, the opposing attorney argued that people wanting to defend their constitutionally guaranteed rights, even when our government and the courts may fail to do so, is again a threat that voters need to be protected from. We must let the people decide. The petition must go out for signatures. With enough signatures, the initiative becomes a ballot measure. Then the people, not vested interests, and not a single judge, decide. What is at stake here is much bigger than the question of aerial spraying of pesticides. The real issue is our right as the people of Lincoln County to govern in matters that pertain to our fundamental rights. People of all political stripes are sick and tired of having money influence how we vote. If the judge stops circulation of the petition for signatures, thereby supporting the opinion of the attorney opposing our initiative, it means that money can influence not only how we vote, but whether we get to vote at all. We believe in Article 1, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution, where it declares, "All power is inherent in the people, and all free governments are founded on their authority and instituted for their peace, safety, and happiness, and they have at all times a right to alter, reform, or abolish the government in such manner as they may think proper," quote unquote. We look forward to the judge in this case doing the right thing, letting the people decide. Otherwise, those constitutional words aren't worth the paper they are printed on. And that was by Maria Sause, S-A-U-S-E, in case I'm mispronouncing her name. Let the people decide. She is a member of Lincoln County Community Rights, and her article was printed in the Newport News Times on March 11th this year. And because it is spring, I'd like to read a poem by Arthur Honeyman that he wrote in 1986. It's a bloomin' miracle. Mother Nature recycles creative powers by seasonal burstings of beauteous flowers and floods the senses with seductive fragrance, delighting the heart unto poetic romance. It emanates glorious color with wondrous power. All the world loves the marvels of a flower. Arthur Honeyman was born with cerebral palsy. He died at age 68 in 2008. He was a teacher, writer, poet, and indefatigable champion of persons of physical and mental handicaps. Arthur was the most remarkable person I have personally known, and compare him to Helen Keller, Gandhi, and Martin Luther King. He was my closest friend for nearly 40 years. And I'd like to read another poem by him, Spring Rain in Oregon, which he wrote in 1987. Usually an Oregon rain is just mist that softly moistens the landscape and abundantly produces flora and other types of vegetation. But this deluge on a March day is stinking, muck-sucking stuff, which both combats the drought of last year and prepares the way for the annual vernal rebirth by eroding rivuleted canals down into the muddy, fertile terrain so that microbiotic creatures can squirm their ways and etch tracks through suburbia, helping to add humus to the murky foundations for plant life to feed from while simultaneously and symbiotically reaping the benefits of oxygen provided by herbomorphic entities, for water is more than a drink or thirst-quenching liquid, and all aspects of it help shape this imperfect spheroidal planet, both above and below its surface, more exquisitely than Michelangelo sculpted the elegant body of David or the bemuscled torso of a macho godhead angrily pointing Adam and Eve out of paradise forever, as well as much more, for this sparkling, bubbling fluid runs deep in terrestrial existence, recycled from vapor to water to ice that is rain for you, even Oregon rain. And that was Spring Rain in Oregon by Arthur Honeyman. And I think I tripped up over a couple of words, but I hope Arthur will forgive me anyway. And one last poem by Rick Vranya, Astor Library. Hushed school children, bookworms, and clicking computer users in this large reading room fill a rainy Saturday sitting under a poster reading, "A library is not a luxury, but one of the necessities of life." Outside, in the gray rain, the north wall stucco has long lost the last two letters of the town's name, and so it reads, Astor Library. Fitting reminder it is of the East Coast entrepreneur who never saw and may not have known of this place. Somewhere out there in the wild Northwest that may as well have been the Far East was his trading post for otter pelts. Before they decimated the otter, before they decimated the seals, before they decimated the almost endless salmon, while on land were likewise decimated the large cats, wolves, black bear, the anxious enormous trees, the people of old tested communities, all documented in the very fine museum that shows us what we lost and what remains, a struggling American seaport fish town, striving toward survival, conceived not so much in malice as in ignorance, the inevitable prize of some sort of enterprise, rich men call free. And that was Astor Library by Rick Vranya, poet and cartographer who died on March 26th, 2016, the day before Easter. And I know I will miss him very much. A planned trip to Astoria this month with him, I guess, has been eternally canceled. And this has been Michael McCusker.